Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. Even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And he messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what happened is, When God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt. I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way. Your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box going to get sent back to sender. And now you're going to have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a chap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week. 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, "Shoot it!" So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Taking a risk with our supply, ain't you? I mean, setting up a meet with anybody other than us.
Got to. The boy crave reassurance.
Boss, you get that boy Marlo in line on our connect. He might try to go around the co-op. Go around us. You know what I'm saying?
Cautious as those Greeks be, who you think they gonna trust? They know us. They don't know him.
Damn. Look at this nigga coming around.
Easy, son. Easy.
Yeah, I might have known I'd find you boys in here burning that oil after hours.
Nigga, I'm gonna kill you twice.
Oh? You don't want your shipment, huh?
Say your piece.
Well, it just so happened I got some heroin for sale. Market-wise, you fellas look like buyers, you feel me?
This some shameless shit.
Boy, ain't no shame in my game, dog. I'm here about the business. Ain't that right, Joe?
How much?
20 on the dollar.
10, nigga.
Don't make me say 25 now.
That's 400,000.
How about we take your faggot ass in the back room and get into some diabolical brutality? Find our shit the old-fashioned way. Feel me?
Oh, I feel you. Sound like a plan.
I don't know, though, Joe. You think Omar gonna give it up?
20 on the dollar it is.
Say, how's she taking, Joe?
And that scene was from the television program The Wire. And a pretty interesting season. I think we went like five, six seasons. So probably at least five. Anyway, if you haven't checked it out, check it out. Anyway, okay, and thank you, Reba, for that. The audio is a little bit too low on that last one I played. In any event, today's, hopefully you can hear me normal right now. Open mic, anything you guys want to talk about, what I have as a headline today is creating affordable housing. And that's something that everybody can, well, who has interest in it to get involved with creating affordable housing, which is much needed because you do have a severe Depends on the city, though. Severe housing, affordable housing crisis, so to speak. But in any event, open mic, any trending topics that you want to discuss out here. I think they had another mass shooting or something. I think Louisville, Kentucky. So anything you got, 619-768-2945. That's the number to call. If you want to promote something, hit us with a trending topic. Or, you know, because there's a lot of, there's a few trending topics out there. So 619-768-2945 and just press 1 here on this Thursday. Yesterday we played a audio from a forthcoming book called Starting, From Scratch by Mignon Francois, the woman, the lady that took $5 and has flipped it into over 5 million cupcakes and millions of dollars. And like we yesterday, that's what we were focused on. I'm trying to find. Okay, we'll be back right after this break.
Listen, I want to talk to you poor people, your middle class people, and the ones who thought they made it. Listen to this. I want to talk to the short and the tall. This ain't no racial matter. This thing concerns us all. Do you know one thing?
Prices going up and out of sight.
Listen, charging $3 a half a pound for pork chops. Man, that ain't right. And put this in your hat and smoke it.
The best of me.
Listen, do you know the only time I feel strange is when I'm looking at a cowboy picture on TV? And you listen to this. If you notice they're charging too much for a
black eyed and butter bean,
I can't even afford to put that back in my car. I went to the store the other day and had my basket sacked. Things cost so damn much, I had to throw it all back. How they look for a poor man to get ahead? Say they gonna charge a dollar and a half for a near old loaf of bread.
You tell me that ain't crisis.
We got to do something about these
prices.
Yes, we are. You tell me that ain't inflation. Lord, these prices about to drive me
crazy.
Listen, I think I'll write my congressman and my senator too. I'm gonna even call the press, see what can he do. If you go to the store today with $40, the people call you a drag. You can bring that little old food bag and two little old paper bags. Do you know that? Look here, have you dug the price of sugar, flour and meal? Things like that'll make a poor man steal. And they tell you, don't worry about it. We're gonna look out for you. You got a chance. We'll make it up to you with food stamps. Get on up there. Lord, listen. The Abbey suit today.
Talk about prices.
I'll run you two in the water.
Talk about prices.
The way things are going up.
Talk about prices.
You're gonna have to start paying for a drink of water.
Talk about prices.
$75 for a pair of shoes and $50 for a hat. That don't make no damn sense for things to be costing like that. Things is getting so tough, my dog is even scared to bear his bones. When he comes back to look for it, some poor joker done dug it up and carried it home. My cat can't find a rat in the alley, all of them packed up and left. He's sitting down eating onions and about to cry himself to death. Talking about prices and prices, y'all.
Prices and prices.
I'm talking about prices and prices. They got to bring them down so we can survive.
Prices and prices.
Do you remember the fuel prices?
Prices and
cry. Daylight broke on me one day and I was headed for the cemetery. I said, hold it, y'all, I ain't going for that. You should have seen me making a U-turn with my Cadillac and started saying, crisis and crisis.
Crisis and crisis.
Bring them down.
Crisis and crisis.
Okay. 773, your mic is open. 773, mic open. Your mic, 773, your mic is open. You might be on mute. Okay, 773, you're going to leave your mic open. And just speak up when you're available. 309 area code, your mic is open.
Hey, good morning, LA.
Good morning, Chris.
Well, spring is here. It's beautiful outside, that's for sure. How is your day going today?
Not bad. This is a Florida sunny day here. And by this time next week, I want to, something that Pastor Roland Strand mentioned, they have like on Wednesdays, a community meal. So what I want to organize here and in other satellite places is a meet, greet, and build type thing. We have the food. But we also include actually working on a building project as well. You eat, and then you build.
Yeah, you eat, yeah, that's a great thing.
All right, then Reba will be on in about 30 minutes, so. Maybe I'll close your mic until for about 20 minutes or so. It'll be like a potluck type situation. People bring, a dish or we have to coordinate that because we don't want everybody to bring potato chips. So coordinate on that and then of course you eat and then you build. So.
Sounds like a winner. I've got the truck. I found a trailer and got the what it's going to cost to plate it, put the insurance on it. I got a hold of the factory. They are working on producing the material to do the 50 cities. They're going to do 150 frames. We'll build one, leave two. So we're actually build 100 homes in one day, but it will be 150 homes will be built. So that 7-figure day is
in the works. You'll hit a 7-figure day with that many homes. Right. And you'll definitely get 7 figures with that. What's the in keeping up with what's happening in Orlando with what's his name, Whitfield?
Yes. He's ready.
Yeah,
for
what's happening
for
now?
The packages to show up. That was he's ready for the packages to start coming there, so we can have the displays on site. They have cleared the area, so that's why I started getting the truck trailer material ordered, and I should have the answers about when the material will be ready for us to be able to do things, probably here within a week, I can be on the road delivering material. So I could drive straight down there to his site and set off four or five of them, go to Hamilton County, do the same thing. But my goal was is I'm going to pick up, instead of picking up in Georgia, I'm going to pick up in Louisiana, and I'm going to follow the Gulf Coast, and I'm going to start working cities as I get down
Miami. You'll be on Route 10? I-10?
Yep.
Okay. And that goes east.
So we're going to start, we need to start working that path and getting with church groups, getting with community groups, and set it up. I've got the public relations getting put together now so that we can get every news station to cover that vehicle or the two vehicles. I have an 18-foot box truck as well, and I was thinking of utilizing both of them because there's going to be quite a bit of material when it comes down to 150 houses. But having the two trucks and one following the other and getting a wrap put on both of them, I'm paying for the wrap out of pocket. It would be nice if someone would sponsor it and we could put their names and stuff on it and show that they're supporting getting the community out. So Domino's had reached out to me 2 days ago, and they gave me a phone number. So we're gonna work on that one today about Domino's sponsoring this trip, because for every address that we build is a new client for them, so a new customer. So they liked that idea and the way it came out. So we want to see about building a sponsorship with them. And maybe even job creations for people that we get into our programs.
All right. Give me the price range. This, you told me, but for the people that are listening for the first time, give me the price range of the building and the square footage of the buildings that you're talking about.
Well, we were looking at...
From a tiny house point of view.
From a tiny house point of view. There's many levels. You know, up to 400 square feet is a tiny house. So, you know, I'm looking at running around and doing is going to be 8 feet wide. It'll be 15 feet long, but that will include a 4-foot porch. So it'll have a little front porch on it. I'm going to put a gable. I've got them designed with a little gable roof. I'm not doing the slant. We're doing everything in the conventional vertical standing situations here. So I didn't want to have anybody trying to deal with something that was being built on a slant on the front and back wall. It just works out to give an aesthetic better. I'd rather put the trusses on them. So when I did the package, I did it with the truss pack and the wall packages. And I'm going to have everything cut to length, even the little 6-inch pieces that are needed. So no one has to pick up a saw. All they have to do is pick up a screw gun and start assembling them. And they'll go together really quick. But, yeah, they're basically going to be 8 feet by 15 feet. And those will just be they can be anything. You know, we can build them, you know, bigger But this little thing that I'm trying to do here is just an ignition to show people what their capabilities are. The shapes and how big they are is totally up to what we decide to do in each altercation.
But okay. $10,000 is going to buy that package.
So we need.
No, right, that's a very reasonable price.
$10,000. There's tiny house builders. I'm going to tell you right now. There's tiny house builders, and for 130 or 160 square foot, you are going to pay $25,000 to $35,000, up to $100,000. So it depends on
okay.
your taste and what you want in it, on what people are paying for these things. But I was looking at a whole bunch of different displays of what, you know, someone is offering as far as those, and I seen so many that was $100,000. And, you know, we're talking about something that's 300 square feet, and it's $119,000, and it's not like super high end, but it's nice. But if you wanted, you know, different tiles or different whatever, each of those things is what makes that square footage change on how much it costs to put stuff in. Because there is flooring that's, you know, $8 a foot just to buy the material.
Right.
And that makes a difference on the ball.
Okay.
But it is a very good luxury vinyl, and I suggest it. Don't go with just a cheap snap together little flooring. Go together with something that, you know, would last. You're not just going to scratch. It's not going to, you know, you got a lot of different ways to look at that. But yeah, $10,000 starts the package. You know, we just need people to want to do something.
Well, $10,000 house is very very reasonable, and you know, because you have people out here that are paying $1,000 to $3,000 a month in rent. So, you know, instead of paying high rent like that. Of course, now geography plays a big part in this. Move to an area where you can have a house that, you know, you can either build one or buy one for, you know, that price, you know, the $10,000 to $20,000 range, $25,000 range. Because, like I say, some people are paying rent where within 90 days, you know, they could have paid for a house in its entirety. But more than likely, that's going to be in a geographical area. And there are plenty of places. The United States has over 40,000 towns. From New York City, which has 8 to 9 million people, to little places that have maybe literally one or two people in a town. So out of 40,000, there's, matter of fact, 48% of the United States, they live in towns that have 5,000 people or less. So there's, not just getting nailed down to one place. You got plenty of options that are out there. Let's see. I don't know if Reba's is available yet. Let me check. yeah. What we also want to do is have a sort of an after school program for people that want to learn how to build, including teens. Okay, I'm refreshing. Okay. Let me see if Reba is. 773, are you available yet? I might be coming in a little bit early. Okay, she's not quite available, so we'll give her about 21 minutes. All right, let's take this quick break on the, I think it's a $200 to $500 cap.
It was almost 2 years ago that I started work on a small log cabin in the northern Canadian bush. And it has been exactly a year since I closed the cabin door for the last time and moved away. Finally, I got the chance to return, and I am anxious to see how the cabin has fared the last four seasons on its own. While most parts of North America are enjoying mild spring weather with no snow, my aluminum snowshoes are falling through waist-deep powder and temperatures of minus 20 degrees Celsius. Although this looks like January weather, would you believe that this is late April? It's been a long, hard winter here. Lots of snow and a solid month of minus 40 degree temperatures. There were even a few days that registered right around minus 50. It seems that the lynx population has been hit the hardest this winter. Several locals have reported that their dogs have been attacked by lynx along the hiking trails. Normally, lynx avoid this sort of contact with bigger dogs and humans, but the prolonged cold temperatures have forced them to make desperate decisions. It wasn't far from here that I spotted a mother lynx and her two cubs last year. And of course, I didn't have my camera ready at the time. On my way into the cabin, yet another lynx had silently stalked behind me for a short distance, but it eventually turned off my path and took a different direction. And I wouldn't have noticed it at all if it weren't for the footprints it left behind over my fresh tracks. In building the cabin, I wanted it to be simple for two reasons. Number one, because of the cabin's location, I knew that I'd be having to do everything by hand. Getting the equipment and supplies in, moving and hoisting the logs would all have to be done with good old-fashioned manpower. And reason number two, I didn't have a lot of money to work with. Simple as that. And in this complicated world, simple just seems to offer more. Complicated offers bells and whistles, but simple. Simple offers freedom.
Hi, everyone. 2 years ago, my life changed forever. My wife, Kelsey, and I welcomed our daughter, Leela, into the world. Now, becoming a parent is an amazing, amazing experience. Your whole world changes overnight, and all of your priorities change immediately, so fast that it makes it really difficult to process sometimes. Now, you also have to learn a tremendous amount about being a parent. Like, for example, how to dress your child. This was new to me. This is an actual outfit. I thought this was a good idea. And even Leela knows that it's not a good idea. So there was so much to learn and so much craziness all at once. And to add to the craziness, Kelsey and I both work from home. We're entrepreneurs. We run our own businesses. So Kelsey is a develops courses online for yoga teachers. I'm an author. And so I'm working from home. Kelsey's working from home. We have an infant, and we're trying to make sure that everything gets done that needs done. And life is really, really, really busy. And a couple weeks into this amazing experience, when the sleep deprivation really kicked in, like around week 8, I had this thought, and it was the same thought that parents across the ages, internationally, everybody has had this thought, which is, I am never going to have free time ever again. And somebody said it's true. Yeah, it's not exactly true, but it feels really, really true in that moment. And this was really disconcerting to me, because one of the things that I enjoy more than anything else is learning new things, getting curious about something and diving in and fiddling around and learning through trial and error and eventually becoming pretty good at something. And without this free time, I didn't know how I was ever going to do that ever again. And so I'm a big geek. I want to keep learning things. I want to keep growing. And so what I decided to do was go to the library and go to the bookstore and look at what research says about how we learn and how we learn quickly. And I read a bunch of books. I read a bunch of websites. And trying to answer this question, how long does it take to acquire a new skill? You know what I found? 10,000 hours. Anybody ever heard this? 10,000, it takes 10,000 hours. If you want to learn something new, if you want to be good at it, it's going to take 10,000 hours to get there. And I read this in book after book and website after website, and my mental experience of reading all of this stuff was like, no! I don't have time. I don't have 10,000 hours. I am never going to be able to learn anything new ever again. But that's not true. So 10,000 hours, just to give you a rough order of magnitude, 10,000 hours is a full-time job for 5 years. That's a long time. And we've all had the experience of learning something new, and it didn't take us anywhere close to that amount of time, right? So what's up? There's something kind of funky going on here. What the research says and what we expect and have experiences, they don't match up. And what I found, here's the wrinkle. The 10,000-hour rule came out of studies of expert-level performance. There was a professor at Florida State University. His name is K. Anders Ericsson. He's the originator of the 10,000-hour rule. And where that came from is he studied professional athletes, world-class musicians, chess grandmasters, all of these ultra-competitive folks in ultra-high-performing fields, and he tried to figure out, how long does it take to get to the top of those kinds of fields? And what he found is the more deliberate practice, the more time that those individuals spent practicing the elements, whatever it is that they do, the more time you spend, the better you get. And the folks at the tippy top of their fields put in around 10,000 hours of practice. Now, we're talking about the game of telephone a little bit earlier. Here's what happened. An author by the name of Malcolm Gladwell wrote a book in 2007 called Outliers, The Story of Success. And the centerpiece of that book was the 10,000-hour rule. Practice a lot, practice well, and you will do extremely well. You reach the top of your field. So the message, what Dr. Ericsson was actually saying is, it takes 10,000 hours to get to the top of an ultra-competitive field in a very narrow subject. That's what that means. But here's what happened. Ever since Outliers came out, immediately came out, reached the top of the bestseller list, stayed there for 3 solid months. All of a sudden, the 10,000-hour rule was everywhere. And a society-wide game of telephone started to be played. So this message, it takes 10,000 hours to reach the top of an ultra-competitive field, became, it takes 10,000 hours to become an expert at something, which became, it takes 10,000 hours to become good at something, which became, it takes 10,000 hours to learn something. But that last statement, it takes 10,000 hours to learn something, it's not true. It's not true. So what the research actually says, if I spent a lot of time here at the CSU library in the cognitive psychology stacks because I'm a geek. And when you actually look at the studies of skill acquisition, you see over and over and over a graph like this. Now, researchers, whether they're studying a motor skill, something you do physically, or a mental skill, they like to study things that they can time, because you can quantify that, right? So they'll give research participants a little task, something that requires physical arrangement or something that requires learning a little mental trick, and they'll time how long a participant takes to complete the skill. And here's what this graph says. When you start, so when researchers gave participants a task, it took them a really long time because it was new and they were horrible. With a little bit of practice, they get better and better and better, and that early part of practice is really, really efficient. People get good at things with just a little bit of practice. Now, what's interesting to note is that if, you know, we don't really, for skills that we want to learn for ourselves, we don't care so much about time, right? We just care about how good we are, whatever good happens to mean. So if we relabel performance time to how good you are, the graph flips, and you get this famous and widely known, this is the learning curve. And the story of the learning curve is when you start, you're grossly incompetent and you know it, right? With a little bit of practice, you get really good really quick. So that early level of improvement is really fast. And then at a certain point, you reach a plateau, and the subsequent gains become much harder to get. They take more time to get. Now, my question is, I want that, right? How long does it take from starting something and being grossly incompetent and knowing it to being reasonably good in, hopefully, as short a period of time as possible? So, how long does that take? Here's what my research says. 20 hours. That's it. You can go from knowing nothing about any skill that you can think of. Want to learn a language? Want to learn how to draw? Want to learn how to juggle flaming chainsaws? If you put 20 hours of focused, deliberate practice into that thing, you will be astounded, astounded at how good you are. 20 hours is doable. That's about 45 minutes a day for about a month, even skipping a couple days here and there. 20 hours isn't that hard to accumulate. Now, there's a method to doing this, because it's not like you can just start fiddling around for about 20 hours and expect these massive improvements. There's a way to practice intelligently. There's a way to practice efficiently that will make sure that you invest those 20 hours in the most effective way that you possibly can. And here's the method. It applies to anything. The first is to deconstruct the skill. Decide exactly what you want to be able to do when you're done, and then look into the skill and break it down into smaller and smaller pieces. Most of the things that we think of as skills are actually big bundles of skills that require all sorts of different things. The more you can break apart the skill, the more you're able to decide what are the parts of the skill that will actually help me get to what I want, and then you can practice those first. And if you practice the most important things first, you'll be able to improve your performance in the least amount of time possible. The second is learn enough to self-correct. So get 3 to 5 resources about what it is you're trying to learn. Could be books, could be DVDs, could be courses, could be anything. But don't use those as a way to procrastinate on practice. I know I do this, right? Get like 20 books about the topic. It's like, I'm going to start learning how to program a computer when I complete these 20 books. No, that's procrastination. What you want to do is learn just enough that you can actually practice and self-correct or self-edit as you practice. So the learning becomes a way of getting better at noticing when you're making a mistake and then doing something a little different. The third is to remove barriers to practice. Distractions, television, internet, all of these things that get in the way of you actually sitting down and doing the work. And the more you're able to use just a little bit of willpower to remove the distractions that are keeping you from practicing, the more likely you are to actually sit down and practice, right? And the fourth is to practice for at least 20 hours. Now, most skills have what I call a frustration barrier. You know, the grossly incompetent knowing it part? That's really, really frustrating. We don't like to feel stupid. And feeling stupid is a barrier to us actually sitting down and doing the work. So by pre-committing to practicing whatever it is that you want to do for at least 20 hours, you will be able to overcome that initial frustration barrier and stick with the practice long enough to actually reap the rewards. All right? That's it. It's not rocket science. Four very simple steps that you can use to learn anything. Now, this is easy to talk about in theory, but it's more fun to talk about in practice. So one of the things that I've wanted to learn how to do for a long time is play the ukulele. Has anybody seen Jake Shimabukuro's TED Talk where he plays the ukulele and makes it sound like he's like an ukulele god? It's amazing. It's like I saw that. It's like, that is so cool. It's such a neat instrument. I would really like to learn how to play. And so I decided that to test this theory, I wanted to put 20 hours into practicing the ukulele and see where we got. And so the first thing about playing the ukulele is in order to practice, you have to have one, right? So I got an ukulele, and my lovely assistant. Thank you, sir. I think I need the cord here. It's not just an ukulele, it's an electric ukulele. Yeah. So the first couple hours are just like the first couple hours of anything. You have to get the tools that you're using to practice. You have to make sure that they're available. My ukulele didn't come with strings attached. I had to figure out how to put those on. Like, that's kind of important, right? And learning how to tune and learning how to make sure that all of the things that need to be done in order to start practicing get done, right? Now, one of the things when I was ready to actually start practicing was I looked in online databases and songbooks for how to play songs. And they say, okay, ukuleles, you can play more than one string at a time, so you can play chords. That's cool. You're accompanying yourself. Yay, you. And when I started looking at songs, I had an ukulele chord book that had like hundreds of chords. Like looking at this thing, like, whoa, that's intimidating. But when you look at the actual songs, you see the same chords over and over, right? As it turns out, playing the ukulele is kind of like doing anything. There's a very small set of things that are really important and techniques that you'll use all the time. And so in most songs, you'll use four, maybe five chords, and that's it. That's the song. You don't have to know the hundreds as long as you know the four or the five. So while I was doing my research, I found a wonderful little medley of pop songs by a band called Axis of Awesome. And somebody knows it. And what Axis of Awesome says is that you can learn, or you can play pretty much any pop song of the past five decades if you know four chords. And those chords are G, D, E minor, C. Four chords pump out every pop song ever, right? So I thought, this is cool. I would like to play every pop song ever. So that was the first song I decided to learn, and I would like to actually share it with you. Ready? All right. Just a smile.
small town girl, living in a lonely world. She took a midnight train going anywhere. I heard that you settled down, that you found a girl, that you're married now. Every night in my dreams I see you, I feel you. That's just how I know we'll go on. I won't hesitate no more, no more. It cannot wait, I'm yours. Cause you are amazing. We did amazing things. If I could, then I would. I'd go wherever you will. And can you feel the love tonight? Cause it is, with or without you. When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me. Sometimes I feel like I don't have a partner. No woman, no cry, I'm on the surely is a dream. I come from London under. Once a jolly swag man camps by a billabong. Hey, I just met you, and it's crazy. Now here's my number, so call me. Hey, sexy lady, whoop, 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 I'm Gangnam Style. Time to say goodbye. Closing time. Every new beginning comes from some other beginning's end.
Thank you. Thank you. I love that song. And I have a secret to share with you. So by playing that song for you, I just hit my 20th hour of practicing the ukulele. Thank you. And so it's amazing, pretty much anything that you can think of. What do you want to do? The major barrier to learning something new is not intellectual. It's not the process of you learning a bunch of little tips or tricks or things. The major barrier is emotional. We're scared. Feeling stupid doesn't feel good. In the beginning of learning anything new, you feel really stupid. So the major barrier is not intellectual, it's emotional. But put 20 hours into anything. Doesn't matter. What do you want to learn? Do you want to learn language? Do you want to learn how to cook? Do you want to learn how to draw? What turns you on? What lights you up? Go out and do that thing. It only takes 20 hours. Have fun.
Great job.
All right, and tomorrow, listen to that. We're going to unveil something for any of you to participate in. 20 hours for house building. It'll be a tiny house, but 20, if you don't know anything about carpentry or home building or house building, we're going to announce that tomorrow and learn how to build a tiny house. And you'll get the fundamentals where you can build larger than that, but sticking with the basics and the fundamentals, you know, if you don't know anything, 20 hours to house build. That's tomorrow, which is Friday, our podcast for tomorrow. Let's see. 773, your mic is open if you're available.
Yes, greetings. We're right there. How are
greetings.
You today?
So what's new? Fine, you're in Chicago or Milwaukee?
I am in Chicago. I will be in Milwaukee this weekend. But I just realized, you know, as you were speaking, first of all, about tiny homes is one thing. And then I really, really love I always love your audio that you share. Social capital would be something that churches could take advantage of in creating jobs. So I was, as you were speaking about topics, and even with Chris, when he added, you know, the cost of just a simple 400 square foot tiny house. So the thing is, churches could actually assist with, because I actually just partnered with the church that was trying to take over my land where my building was illegally leveled in the Brownsville area of Chicago. So mm-hmm. I decided, well, guess what? I don't have to pay taxes. I don't have to pay taxes. Collaborate with the church, write grants, this, any other. So social capital. I'm going to give them social capital and myself, the youth in the community. It is a church. The new pastor is amazing. There's Bishop Moore over there at Indiana Avenue Pentecostal. I have dreams, but God shows me things. And so I do know that every soul is on a different level. But I met the pastor. He came to shake my hand. I went through his security, as they call it. So really, really amazing his presence. So we do have in common that a garden should be there in that space. I actually had to pray and meditate on that. So the goal is to I'm going to start working on a strategic plan, the 5-year strategic plan, which I know better. I had not done that even when we did that event back in February. So for the Black Youth Metropolis Enterprises for Entrepreneurship, Black actually stands for Brownsville Leadership Academic Center. Okay. So I it was going to be the Black Center and Gardens, Brownsville Black Center and Gardens, where before they tore my building down. So community centers, churches could take vacant land, even if they have they have their building. They don't have a building, they can get land, you know, because ministries, a lot of the times ministers are actually partnering with other ministers, pastors, and bring their congregations to the physical building. And so they have services either together, so forth. Reverend Renee Chandler, who has Faggot Road, he's an author now with his second book. I don't remember the name of the second book, but he actually has been working with another minister sharing their physical space for a while. So I like the idea of Chris's tiny mobile units. You call them homes. I'm looking at community centers, mobile community centers, because you have to go to where the people are, which is what Jesus did. Jesus went, you know, the people that were saved in the church, you know, they were already in the church. So Jesus went out into the community. And I feel that with our tiny mobile solar cabins, we could actually not only teach to build those using social capital, the churches could actually benefit. I'm not going to say everything, but I'm going to share with you off the air about how the government could actually take some interest in what we're doing. So, Chris, I would share that with you, and God just put this on my heart about the trouble that you've gone through. And so just keep in mind, you know, the government wants to see how it can benefit, even when donating to not-for-profit. There's, you know, not only some tax dollars that go to, you know, not-for-profits and community buildings, but private donors and funders can support, you know, not-for-profits and community projects. So, we're going to do the 5-year strategic plan. I like this 20-minute concept. I mean, 20-hour concept.
20 hours.
Awesome.
You know what I like? Let's combine that with. I like what you mentioned, the mobile community center. That's perfect for what we're doing because that's an outreach. You can do that anywhere. So let's combine those two ideas: mobile community center in combination with the 20-hour. House building.
Okay. Awesome. Thanks for letting me share.
Any other trending topics out there?
Well, we have our second.
What happens in Chicago?
Afro-descendant mayor. So we had our first Afro-descendant mayor, Harold Washington, the late Honorable Harold Washington. Again, my father, the late Robert Pease.
Isn't this your third African-American mayor? Because Lightfoot was
So Lori Lightfoot was our second.
She could be considered, she could also probably be considered Native American because Lightfoot sounds like a Native American name.
Certainly. So Brandon Johnson is our second male Afro-descendant. She is our first
Okay, I got it. Okay, you know, second Afro-descendant male. Okay.
She has a female companion, wife or something, so she may not call herself female, because they're a pronoun now. They, them, you know, so I don't even know all that. But certainly, Brandon Johnson is our second Afro-descendant male. Now, one about the African-American thing, just to give you this heads up. Some young man, I do not know what ethnicity, it was a TikTok. My youngest son watches a lot of TikToks. Well, I think a lot of people watch TikToks, but he finds really in-depth thought leaders, and he would just share some things with me. The one, I just overheard something, or maybe it's something I came across, but this young man, he was not an Afro-descendant, but he said, you cannot have two nationalities. There's no such thing. He wasn't trying to just literally call everybody idiots, but it just makes sense. How can you be American, which is a country, and African? You cannot be an African-American. That's not an ethnicity. That's not a nationality. You're... Yeah. So I'm glad to see
that. Good point.
Yeah, you just can't be too.
Yeah, you're putting out some food for thought here. You're putting out some food for thought here. What defines? Matter of fact, I'm adding some more time to the clock on this one. What defines an ethnic group? Matter of fact, let me look up the definition of ethnic.
I was just looking that up to explain to was it my son CJ? Because it was ethnic. Oh, we were talking about Asians.
Okay, let's see. Ethnicity. I got a dictionary here. It says the quality or fact of belonging to a population group or subgroup made up of people who share a common cultural background or descent. Let's see, another definition would be a term that refers to a social to the social and cultural characteristics, backgrounds, and experiences shared by a group of people. These include language, religion, beliefs, values, and behaviors that are often handed down from one generation to the next. And let's see, what are the seven ethnic groups? Okay, you have American Indian or Alaska Native, Asian, Black or African American, Native Hawaiian or other Pacific Islander, or white. Now, I can't agree with all this because when you just say white, you're lumping, even black, you're lumping a whole bunch of people that they're ethnic groups within that. Like, one of the biggest misnomers out here, and somebody can, chime in on it, is the use of the word Caucasian. A lot of times they're referred to somebody who has white skin as Caucasian. it's white folks are basically European. Caucasian,
right.
You have to look at the word. Caucasian is the operative word here. So somebody from Kyrgyzstan, countries, not Pakistan, but Kazakhstan, those are, matter of fact, the over here in the United States, the Kardashians. All right, Robert Kardashian, friend of O.J. Simpson's kids, they're Caucasian. Because Robert Kardashian was originally from, what's the name of that? The country starts with an A. I'll look it up. What countries that start, let me see. Countries starting with alphabet A.
Small country.
Wait a minute. I'm looking it up. Armenia. Okay. Armenia, matter of fact, Albania, let's go to Armenia, because since I brought that up. Armenia. Armenia, let me get to it. And then after that, we're going to go to Albania.
I need to take my vitamins.
All right, here you go. Armenia.
Continent.
Okay. Armenia. I'm going to get an anthropologist on here. Armenia, officially, the Republic of Armenia, is a landlocked country in the Armenian highlands of Western Asia. Okay. The late Robert Kardashian and his daughters and his kids, they're Armenian. Armenia is in Asia. It is not in Europe. Armenians are Caucasian, and they're not white people. England, Ireland, those people, France, Portugal, Spain, Wales, those countries have Germany. Those countries are European countries, and those people are white folks. But they're not Caucasian. Over in this country, we have a tendency to lump anybody with light skin together as white. We do the same thing when it comes to people with a darker skin. We lump them into, because if we go to Africa, well, you probably have 2,000 to 2,500, even maybe 3,000 indigenous languages that are reflections of, the various ethnic groups in Africa. So they might have the same skin tone, but the exact skin tone, but they're of different ethnic groups. They have different languages, they have different histories, different cultures. Although the skin tone might be exactly the same, they're not the same people. Albania, now let's look that up next. All right, so Armenia, like the Kardashians, are not white people. They're not, because they're not European people. Armenia is in Asia. They're in the Caucasus region. They are Caucasian, and Caucasians are not Europeans. Two different races. Let's see. Let's go to Albania. And I believe Mother Teresa was Albanian. Okay. Albania, now, Albania on the southeastern of Europeans' Balkan Peninsula. Okay, let me get to all right. A country in southeastern Europe, all right, Albanians, the ethnic group within Europeans, although they look different from, but they're officially in Europe. Matter of fact, let me see. Countries and let's just narrow this down. Countries in Asia. Because not every country in Asia has Caucasian people. Or you got 48 countries in Asia, and okay, you got Caucasian people would be in Armenia, Georgia, Turkmenistan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Bezaran, I butchered that name, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, those are where Caucasian people are from. If you look at somebody from Georgia, they might look like from somebody from England, but it's a different culture, different ethnic group. But Georgia is in Asia, and those are Caucasian. They're not European. They're not white folks. But like I say, in this country, we lump everybody in together. Now, let's go take a look at a darker hue of people. Let's go to Africa. As a matter of fact, let's go to Nigeria. The largest populated country in Africa. And all right here, I'm looking at on Wikipedia, there are over 525 regional languages in Africa. Over 525 regional languages, and we're talking about indigenous languages, and this is just in Nigeria. There's the Hausa, the Yoruba, Igbo, Fulani, Tiv, Kanuri, Ijaw, and they put the percentages down. None of those languages are labeled black. None of those cultures are labeled black. So if anything, if we're going by this, now I'm just a messenger here. The Federal Republic of Nigeria, which has 36 states and over 525 regional languages. Now they have three national languages, Hausa, Yoruba, and Igbo. That's the three national languages. They also have English as an official language, too. None of the 525 languages and none of the national languages are classified as black. So where do black folks come from? Okay. And yeah. That's just in Nigeria. Yeah, that's just in Nigeria. Let's go to another country. Let's go to Kenya, East Africa.
Okay. Kenya. All right, Kenya, the national language is Swahili. They have two official languages, Swahili and English. And then, you know, there's different categories of English, too, but we're not going to get into that today. Let's see. All right, national language. Now, ethnic groups. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Hold it. Let me get down to. They have over 9 ethnic groups. All right, demographics. Let's see. Kenya has a population of approximately 48 million people. Ethnic groups. Kenya has a diverse population that includes many of Africa's major linguistic groups. There's no official list of Kenyan ethnic groups. The number of ethnic categories and subcategories recorded in the country's census has changed significantly over time, expanding from 42 ethnic groups in 1969 to more than 120 ethnic groups in Kenya in 2019. Most of the residents of Bantus, Nilotes, Kush, Hittic, well, I don't see anything that defines anything as black. All right, so they have at least 120 ethnic groups. Languages. Kenya's various ethnic groups typically speak their mother tongues within their own communities. The two official languages, English and Swahili, are used in varying degrees of fluency for communication with other populations. English is widely spoken in commerce, schooling, and government. Peri-urban, P-E-R-I-urban, and rural dwellers are less multilingual, and many in rural areas speaking only their native languages. British English is primarily used in Kenya. Additionally, a distinct local dialect, Kenyan English, is used by some communities and individuals in the country. Oops, I lost my page on that. Okay, let me backtrack. Okay. Okay, I'm looking. All right, let's go to another country, South Africa. Okay, South Africa. All right, South Africa, let's see what's happening there. South Africa has 11 official languages. Zulu, Hosa, Afrikaans, English, Sepida, Swazi, Stoloso, and some other names like that. Well, they got 11 official languages. English is just one of them. Okay. And then they have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Then they got a bunch of other languages. Okay. Classifies special status. Ethnic groups. Now, here they do use the word black. 80.7% of the population in South Africa they have defined as black. 8.8% colored. 7.9% they classify as white. And 2.6% Asian. Now that's the way Wikipedia's got it laid out. So that's the first official black that I've come across in Africa.
You see demographics. Let's see. All right, now, South Africa, well, like I said, they have several different languages, indigenous. And once again, 11 official languages, most of which are indigenous. But when it comes to ethnic groups, differing from in Nigeria, there's no black ethnic group. However, in South Africa, there is a black ethnic group. Let's take a look. It's, and you, Kenya doesn't have a black group either. Let's look at Uganda real quick.
Let me share about Haiti when we get a chance. Yeah.
Sure, yeah. Go ahead, Rita. Go ahead.
My son asked if Haitians speak Spanish. So that led us to do some research, which I knew, I did tell him that I knew this. I met some
Haitians. They speak French.
And they spoke French.
They speak,
right.
They speak French.
So,
they speak
so,
French.
But it's been something growing.
Oh, and they have, they also have their own. In Haiti, they also have, I think, matter of fact, let me look it up. I think they have their own Creole language, too. I had to look that up, though.
Yes, it's French Creole, Creole French. They do, yeah. So,
right.
The Spanish connect is because a former black slave actually, he initiated a battle to get the land. It is considered the first black-led republic in the 19th century.
Oh, no doubt. Haiti is the first and the only black republic in the entire Western Hemisphere.
Yeah,
you know, on
the
Haitian
yeah.
side of the island, Hispaniola, yeah, they speak French and they own Creole Haitian. But on the other side of the island, which is the Dominican Republic, they speak Spanish.
And I think that's where the confusion comes in, because they think Latin descent, Hispaniola, but they actually, the leaders actually battled against Spain in order to obtain
right.
some of the territory, yeah.
Okay. Let's see. I'm reading about Haiti right now. The language, the two official languages of Haiti are French and Haitian Creole. All right.
Yeah.
French is the principal written and administratively authorized language, as well as the main language of the press, and spoken by 42% of Haitians. It is spoken by all educated Haitians. It is the medium of instruction in most schools and is used in the business sector. It is used in ceremonial events such as weddings, graduations, church masses. Haiti is one of two independent nations in the Americas, along with Canada, to designate French as an official language. Haitian Creole, which has recently undergone a standardization, is spoken by virtually the entire population of Haiti. Haitian Creole is one of the French-based Creole languages. It is its vocabulary is 90% derived from French, but its grammar resembles that of some West African languages. It also has influences in Tiano, Spanish, and Portuguese. Haitians often colloquially call Haitian Creole Kiro. Haitian Creole is related to other to the other French Creoles, but closely related to Antillean Creole and Louisiana Creole variants. So in Haiti, they identify as Haitian, not black. So,
right.
it, you know, it, I guess it comes down to the individual or the culture. A of how people identify.
Well, was
but
that
with
you?
Haiti,
it was...
Go ahead. I'm
I was listening to some. I don't know if it was a podcast or YouTube. Was that you that mentioned that Africans do not? They don't use the word black to identify themselves. They refer to their ethnicity.
They refer to their ethnic group. Yep, they refer to their ethnic group or nationality. Like in the Dominican Republic, the typical person from the Dominican Republic, if you say they're black, they'll say, no, 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 I'm not black. I'm Dominican.
Right.
If you go to Puerto Rico, same thing. If you go to Colombia, same thing. If you go to Cuba, you know, because you have Cubans with light skin, white skin tone, and black as color, they refer to themselves as Cuban. You know, when, what was that, the movie Hotel Rwanda, in Rwanda, matter of fact, let me go.
I could never get through that movie. I'm always... 7 times at least.
Yeah, I got to watch it again. I got through it. I got through it.
I don't know. Maybe I watched it too late in the night.
Rwanda, let me see. Okay, Rwanda. Because when they had that war, it basically came down to, all right, there's at least 1, 2, 3, 4, at least 5 or 6 ethnic groups in Rwanda. When they had that war where like 900,000 people were killed in about 90 days, it was primarily between the Hutu and the Tutsi, or Tutsi. Yeah. Two ethnic groups, they look alike skin-wise. And you go on YouTube and you can see them sitting right next to each other. But two different ethnic groups. But they do not refer to themselves as black. That's how they roll over there. Okay. Where over here, we have a tendency to lump everybody together by skin tone. Now, there's some exceptions because you have Vietnamese that are your skin complexion, Reba. You have Vietnamese, your skin complexion. And you have Latin Americans. You have people from Mexico, your skin color, Belizeans, your skin color, Colombia, Argentinians. So anyway, interesting topic on how people identify. Okay, I'm trying to find my way back. I forgot how we got on this topic. But, I forgot how we even got on this. All right, well, anyway, what else you got on the plate, Reba, for today?
Well, Minister Plump was going to call in. He was talking about a press release for the Harold Washington Foundation March. So that is Saturday. So I guess I'll text him to see if he can still, you know, call in before we get off the air.
I don't see him on the board yet. Okay, because he's pretty busy. Seems like he's got something always going on.
Yeah. And by the way, Mama Evelyn, actually, she is one of the leaders in the community encouraging Afro descendants to declare our ethnicity on our nationality on our different forms and so forth. So I actually, and you could even write it in. If it says other, you could just write it in.
Okay.
No. So this says African-American. It really, I've got to figure out who that guy is that says that, but it makes sense. It was a TikTok, certainly. So you cannot be two nationalities. You cannot be America and Africa, Americans and Africans. Those are countries.
You make a very good, that's a very good point. You can't be two nationalities.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I would say that Afro descendants who deny being black is not to demean or to negate their Afro descendant cultures, their blood, is the bloodline. It's actually to recognize that black is it's a color, not an ethnic. I thought I just heard an accident. Our truck's out. They're doing some construction outside. So, yeah, so black is a color, like a color, you know, on pen and paper. It's also doesn't recognize. So they're very proud people, and it doesn't recognize who they truly are, where they come from. So that's not for Afro descendants in the States to be offended and say, oh, they don't like us. They don't, they feel that they're better than us. But actually, one thing about it, my sons and I talk about a neighbor that we had when I purchased my first home from my mother's estate, I kid you not, Nyarko, CJ, Nyarko, they were from Nigeria. I think they were from Nigeria, our neighbors. So the father, the husband, he had a taxi service, and the children were not really allowed to commingle with just anybody. They went to school. They had a few friends. They came home, and they had just their routine. They did their homework, and mind you, my children were the same age. So they were invited because he saw style, and I was divorced by then, single mom. He saw my style. But then when my sons, because he would always ask how they're doing in school. they were getting, his church was getting donations from Panera Bread and things like that. So he would share. But at one point, he was holding two bags. The father was holding two bags. And my son and I went to the door. So my son was looking to, you know, take the bags in. And so my neighbor, just, he was talking to my son, just been trying to encourage him about that education piece. And he kept holding the bag. My son was getting more and more angry. I was like, be cool, you know. So, but I just really, even to this day, he's like, yeah, well, you know, it's like almost like, because my guy's the same way. He just wants to captivate your attention. It's not like, okay, I'm dangling this in your face. It's just a matter of I want to share my heart. You know, this is just nothing. What I have is mm-hmm. nothing, you know. So I'm trying to get through to my sons that it's not necessary. It's what you can get out of a situation. So analyze the situations and take what you can use. Don't necessarily feel like it's a judgment on you. That person may actually even has an idea to say, okay, well, you know, if I give you this $20, then, you know, I want you to actually show me that you're listening to my advice, you know. But it's really actually I will explain, God just gave me this in my spirit. They don't want you to walk away. They really want to captivate your attention. It's not it's no harm intended or anything demeaning to say that, okay, well, I'm not gonna hand this $20 over to you that I know that you need. I really want to convey my heart to you. Because people don't have to talk to you about anything, you know, just under the moon. They just really actually spending that time and energy to convey what's on their heart concerning you. So I just think that it's worth to take a listen to people that you do trust. So keep in mind,
right.
My sons trust, you know, my fiance, you know, to a certain degree, but I've had to encourage them. Well, you need to call him. If you feel that he has something to offer, call him. You know, and I also tell them, you know, reach out to the old neighbors and things like that, because my block was one to be reckoned with. We were so close. I mean, it was a couple of situations here and there, like, you know, no fights or nothing, but just, you know, people have different personalities. But our neighbors, like, I was divorced by the time, let me see, my youngest son was like maybe 3, And so I had a lot of support, even around the corner. My friend Anita, God rest her soul, she was like, Reba, I know I saw, you know, the children out playing, or I invited them over. Yeah, I'm going to feed them dinner. I'll pick them up from school. And, you know, or if they were playing with her children, she was like, okay, they're already fed, and they bring you a plate home, you know? So, yeah, really, really amazing. I meant to get, while I was still living over there, get Oprah to take a look at us when her show was really at its peak, the Oprah Winfrey Show. I was like, look, she needs to recognize this block here, block.
I wish you would have stayed and kept Harpo in Chicago.
Yeah, yeah, pretty interesting.
He moved
out.
What did they do with that building?
I don't know. I was somewhat homeschooling them. It was a virtual charter school, one of the first hybrid, actually the first hybrid charter school. And so they would do 2.25 hours in class, because by law you have to have physical class instruction by law. So the other education piece was done at home by the parents. So they sent the computers and the other, and it was in the West Loop area. So I saw it years ago. I had not been over that way since. I have no idea, but I will find out. And I would probably just stop by. I also used to pay my insurance. I had Lincoln Insurance. I paid my insurance over that way. And I saw Harpo Studios. So. I actually do not know.
Well, yeah, she, she moved out, so.
Oh, yeah.
But Obama, they're building his presidential library there, right?
Yeah, it's, looks like it's slow motion, though. It's like, they have, like, what's that? South Shore Drive. What street is that? Lake Shore. Well, the thing is, they have the street is like, it has, you know, some interesting traffic delays. It's okay. They do have 2-lane traffic. So that's what I was noticing as I drive through there. It's going to be really nice. I see some progress, but, I'll certainly bring someone on who can tell you more about that, too, you know. You like to, you know, share, talk about that, because who would follow that? Oh, mm-hmm. Darrell Hooten. He actually had an idea to, you know, work with the seniors in that particular project. Oh, and then the owner of the Grand Ballroom mentioned that he's not too far from the presidential library where it's going to be. So it's going to bring him more business as well. And that's on 63rd and Cottage Grove. That's where we had our last event.
All right. Reba, now, give us more of your vision on these mobile community centers.
Well, if you go to where the people are, we could take advantage of what you are sharing with us is social capital. Because people want to feel useful. They want others to find some value in them. It's a matter of just kind of, even with the Habitat for Humanity, where the individuals have to, they are encouraged. I think they're obligated. It's an obligation to help build the house that you will be living in. So with these tiny home structures, social capital would be the people. You know, you can help someone build them a house. And then the church would have this involvement, whereas, you know, the food pantry. Because remember you and I talked about having a garden attached or on top of the unit, rooftop gardens where they can actually grow some of their own food. So I certainly had been, you know, pondering on how the churches could be involved. And the church where my land is located in the Brownsville area, okay, even that space, remember I told you I had a space to build, we could actually have, you know, 5 projects going at one time. So So that land is a half block long, including my parcel. That's actually, yeah, from the church's parking lot and all the way to the south end of the block. So that's, no, there's another lot in between. Yeah, there's another lot in between. So it's not all grass. But there are three parcels of land, three or four parcels of land that are grass. So it could be built. Like you said, it only takes a parking space. So to build, you know, one.
Right.
So, yeah, so... yeah, there's some, I have a whole strategic plan that I put on my heart and, we'll just lay it out, but certainly the social capital is a big part of it. The church is having, even if they don't have a food pantry, there may be a church nearby, and that would connect us to the concept that God gave me, that Pastor John Hanna, actually, one of his members, I'm sure brought it to him, but we're Facebook friends, but there, God gave me 24/7 unity and love. And the idea was not for a church, which Pastor John Hanna and his, you know, the members, they had the church open for 24 hours for 7 days. That was not the concept. Mm-hmm. And I continue to warn before anybody did that in Facebook land that the concept is to have one church open for 24 hours within that 7-day period. Just okay. To have resources available. You don't do everything. At your church, one church cannot possibly do everything. However, you share resources. First of all, even if there's a social worker in the church, you can't handle 300 cases, you know, in 1 month. It's just humanly impossible. So you would do the referrals, community-based referrals, and that way the 7 churches that are within, let's say, that 8-block radius, you have a collaboration. You have some unity
right. In
the love of God and just sharing resources. No, okay, yes, you want your congregation to be recognized as for doing this, and you love your pastor, but you all don't have what every other church has. You have what you have, so just to actually empower others and also with what you do. And... I'm going to just say this part, but I'm not going to say everything regarding my strategic plan. However, what a lot of churches don't realize that they should actually start off, and I'm just speaking as a consultant now, when you actually have collaboration, or if you start, let me say this, when you have resources within a church for the community, it's best to separate the church from the, have a separate not-for-profit, be it a daycare center, be it a community program. At Christ Bible Church, we have Maranatha Institute, and we have the church pantry. So, and it gets different funding, and the understanding is the separation of church and state, which is a government law. Separation of church and state, which really means that you can't commingle certain funds. You just can't commingle funds, you know.
Right.
So if something is for a certain purpose, you cannot use it for, let's say, to benefit the structure of the church, the building fund. That's why they have a separate building fund, too. So there's some knowledge
right.
Base that is amongst the church leaders. However, I was a board member for the Greater Ashburn Community Development Corporation. And as we were forming the GACDC, we were advised. We had gotten help by Stone. What was it? Richard Stone? What was the name of the Stone, he and his wife out of Loyola University. We met at Loyola University in order to get, no, I'm sorry. That was another organization. That was another under, I was with another organization. We met at Loyola University, but Chapman and Cutler. Chapman and Cutler were our advisors with GACDC, and I connected GACDC to Good City, which is now dissolved, which is a very interesting topic. I'll share that with you sometime. But that Good City actually was who we got a lot of. I got a lot of my knowledge from. It was hard to get some of the members who are working 9 to 5 to go to some of the Good City meetings because they were actually struggling just to empower and to strengthen community organizations. So Good City is interesting. They were actually formed to do that. But Chapman and Cutler advised us to separate, to start a separate community organization, which was the Greater Ashburn Community Development Corporation. So we came up with the name and things like that. I moved away from the community, but there was just some things that, like, just one point, I just want to share this, and may kind of be off on a tangent, but we were having a board meeting, and we were putting together, we were actually filling out the 1023, the 501c3 paperwork to get our, to get established as a federal not-for-profit, federally tax-exempt not-for-profit. And one of our board members was an attorney. Well, they wanted to overlook what I was sharing. I was not teaching at the time. I was not teaching, but I was a community leader. However, because I didn't have this law degree, they didn't want to recognize what I was pointing out. I said, look, before we move further, we need to look at Section 11E because it's checked out here that we are a charitable, a foundation. Well, a foundation, in my research and my experience in having a not-for-profit, and I've never got the 501c3 status, I'm actually looking at the 501k because I do child care. I'm an educator, so which would allow us to be less competitive for those grants. So that's just a tip for those listening. So now the Section 11E says if you're a foundation, keep in mind foundations are limited to actually being structured as a foundation. So the general a 501c3, and then there's 501c3A, 501c3A10B, and all that kind of stuff. So you got to kind of look at what you're organized for and what you want to do with your federally tax-exempt organization. So they were like, oh, well, yeah, Helen, what do you think? Now, mind you, I just pointed it out. If you're a foundation, you would not have the same liberties as a general 501c3. That's why they say general 501c3. Okay. Well, Helen, she's an attorney, a brand new attorney at that. Not only do I have a law background, but it's pretty interesting. She was so tactful and professional and the beautiful spirit anyway. Helen said, well, I think we should just move on because she didn't know. She did not know. We should move on. And then I let it ride, and then we came back around to it because I was like, look, I'm a part of this unit, this body. And I didn't say that, but in my mind, I was like, Lord, just let me, because I knew they were overstepping me and just like, not that I had any authority, we were on the same level, but because this is an attorney, just because an attorney is an attorney doesn't mean that they know about a not-for-profit. Each attorney has their area of expertise as well. So keep in mind, she was a real estate attorney. Her partner had a different area. Actually, Helen actually went into family law as well. She was a family law attorney as well as real estate, and then her partner had one in common area of practice and then another two areas. So that was just something interesting to consider. I did encourage the body to diversify our board of directors, so Helen was a good piece to add. However, attorneys do research. So Helen was a good spirit, and she was very tactful. She didn't want to admit that she didn't know. But I think we should move on because they were belabored. Some things were belabored, and we're trying to understand a lot of intellectuals around the room. He was an assistant principal at the time, Jared Brown from Langhampton Elementary, and I was a school leader there. So it was a good body, but people had to be available to get that help from Good City because you need to know how to run a not-for-profit if you've never run one, So I wasn't trying to be the know-it-all, but I was like, look. So I brought the issue back up. I said, just because we weren't really officially going by Robert's Rules of Order, but I brought it back up. I said, look, I said, this is what I wanted to explain. and I was calm. Because it's like, you know, it's like when you kind of overlook, because I'm not a type of person that's like, oh, I have this degree, and I have, because I generally have more education than the average teacher with a bachelor's degree, because I'm a lifetime student, you know, and I love to learn. I have CPSA University tonight at 7. So, yeah, we have our convention town hall for PPSA, National PPSA, under the auspices. I'm under the leadership of Dr. Carmen Palmer, who's a retired Spanish teacher. And Dr. Lois Gaino, who is our National PPA district leader. So, so I just wanted to share that. Keep in mind when you know if you're a not-for-profit, you structure your board, be diverse. You even want to have a young person on your board. Even if it's an 18-year-old, you want them to be adult age, 18, 21 years of age. You want to be, but for me, they did recognize that, okay, at that point I was divorced, I had children, so they were like, okay, you're single, what do you want to do? But that's, I have another conversation for that, and I'll tell you what happened with this program that we implemented.
Okay, well,
tomorrow
come back because we want to organize the 20-hour house building, a 20-hour tiny house building, along with the community,
mobile community center. Yeah.
So let's cover that tomorrow in this entirety.
And I'll share with you offline the strategic plan.
Okay, good. Yeah, Chris. Is open.
Yes, sir. Hey, Reba, how are you today? I'm loving listening to you.
I am well. Thank you. How are you?
I wound up having a meeting earlier with a lady that has a TV show there in Chicago, and she wants to do a show with, I've got a few other people that are here there in Chicago right now. One of them's from out of the country, and the other one is, just came up from Florida, but he's there. He's been part of my organization for a while, but wanting to kind of get everybody together, and even the youth program with the cars.
Okay.
And all of us do a show with her.
Okay.
And see about getting some things moving there in Chicago.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you.
Okay, well, Chris, you read the last word for the day. I mean, any last words, Chris, before we wrap up?
No, get ready for the 50 cities. It looks like I'm going to be doing the Eastern Seaboard. So I'm going to be going down the Gulf Coast, down to Miami, making the turn, and coming back up to Orlando and every other one, all the way up to Hamilton County, whatever. We're going to keep on going until I drop off the 50 frames. If I can drop off the 50 frames before I get past North Carolina, I'm going to go over to Georgia. As we activate those 50 cities, I'm going to pick up another load, and I'm going to continue on to New York.
All right.
So
sounds good.
We're going to see about doubling this up.
Okay, all right. Well, that's the wrap-up for today. Tomorrow we'll be back with Reba and the 20-hour building in combination with the mobile community center.